Welcome to episode 133 of the Star Trek Academy podcast. Today we're all about Star Trek Discovery Season 5, the episode Face the Strange. I'm the Academy Media Professor, Michael Merrick.
And I'm the Academy Philosophy Professor, Rodney Cupp. And as always, we're going to begin with a brief summary of this episode, something to jog your memory if you're listening to this later on. Be advised, though, that there are spoilers in this summary, and in fact, I guess, in the rest of the podcast. But with our summary this time is Dr. Michael Merrick.
Thank you. Discovery is at the location where Janal said they would find the next clue to the progenitor tech. Last episode, right at the end, Maul planted a bug, literally and figuratively, on Adira. It's a tiny little critter used back during the Temporal Wars, and now it's a black market way of throwing enemies into time loops, which happens to Burnham, Rayner, and Stamets. They loop to the battle right before Discovery jumped to the future, back when Discovery was under construction in San Francisco and some other stops. To break the loop, they have to drop out of maximum warp without doing whatever it is they usually do to protect the ship. So now Time Burnham has to convince the bridge crew of Lorca-era Discovery, including the past version of herself, that she really is a time traveler on a critical mission. But our heroes do manage it by convincing the past Discovery crew that they're not shape-changers and really do know them, offering details that are not in any file or record. So it's down to the last second, but it works. The timeline is restored while the time loop is going on. Maul and Locke have apparently been there, taken whatever the clue was, and at the end of the episode, Discovery heads out to try to track them down.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Now, before we get to the philosophy and the themes and the morals in this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the production of this episode and the production design. And, Michael, last time we were wondering what Maul passed to Adira on Trill, and I like how they use that match cut early in the teaser to indicate that it was a time bug that they acquired from a black market dealer 15 hours before this episode begins.
Yeah, the episode marks the second time Discovery has used a time loop story. Previous one was in season one, you remember, with Harry Mudd putting them through loop after loop for revenge against Lorca.
Yeah, now can you imagine if the time bug had sent them back into that loop?
Two intersecting time loops, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. It wasn't directly alluded to on screen, but I think Burnham and Stamets do benefit from this not being their first time loop rodeo. They know what they need to do to not change the timeline because they've been through it before. So it was a strange situation, but I think they adapted to it fairly well. This episode requires a lot of technobabble, and a lot of it centered on Stamets making all these proclamations about how time loops work and how to exit them. He is a scientist, so I guess we're supposed to assume that he has a theoretical basis for all of these pronouncements.
Yeah, and thankfully Reno shows up a few times in this episode and makes it better, but we should mention that he does get a little help from Reno on this problem.
You know, and it makes you wonder whether she was joking when she asked Stamets if he was in a time loop, or did she have it figured out and know that she just couldn't stay there to protect the timeline?
I wonder.
It was interesting that Burnham says Stamets lives outside of time due to his tardigrade DNA. That made me wonder if Guinan's people all have tardigrade DNA, allowing them to have their unique perception outside of linear time.
Makes you wonder.
But Stamets' solution is that Discovery has to hurtle along at just absolute maximum warp and then cancel the warp field. And this is apparently different from how starships usually drop out of warp. It's kind of hard to understand why they didn't really articulate that. I mean, we've heard for years about warp fields decaying and all that, which maybe means some kind of more gradual transition out of warp, not so abrupt. But that doesn't, to me, quite fit in with this recent portrayal of starships whooshing down out of warp to a fixed stop. That doesn't seem like a gradual decay type situation.
Yeah, I think they use the phrase break the warp bubble.
Yeah.
And honestly, you know, I didn't follow all that techno babble. I just, you know, just let them have it.
Willing suspension of disbelief.
Exactly. Before we move on, though, I've been thinking about this episode. I think it's a fortunate thing that it was written for season 5, and I presume before they learned Discovery was canceled, because we get to revisit events that occurred during the previous seasons. And you mentioned a few of them. We visit Discovery during the Klingon War. We see the battle with Control, the wormhole to the 32nd century, and we see Osira's attempt to steal the ship. We also see Book and Grudge in Burnham's quarters at some point in the past. And so by my reckoning, that's at least the first 3 seasons. And as Burnham points out, everyone they meet is living in the moment. But Burnham gets to see everything from the outside and think about what it all means. And so do we. So it really was, in a way, a nice way of looking back at the series, don't you think, Michael?
Yeah, and I think about how some of the characters have changed over time, too. Now, Rodney, we see several character relationships in this episode, and I think maybe some seeds are also planted that we'll come back to in the future. Seeing past and present Burnham together really emphasizes how her character has changed and how tough it was for her back in seasons 1 and 2, how hopeless it was, future Burnham tells her past younger self.
Yeah, I was shocked by how different they seemed, past and present Burnham.
Yeah, obviously intentional. At one of the stops in the past, Book is there, as you said, living in Burnham's quarters. She's really weirded out by that.
Yeah.
But she proclaims she loves him, and I don't think she was faking in saying that.
I don't think so either.
That may be planting a seed for them getting back together, which I assume we all expect to happen by the end of the season.
Yeah. Sure.
And am I imagining it, or is there a seed planted about maybe a relationship between Rainer and Reno?
Well, they were talking about buying drinks for each other, maybe.
Yeah, was there a little spark there? I don't know. And, of course, we get to see Arium again, which was interesting. It was nice to see her, and it was a good choice for how the story works.
Yeah, and we also got to see Bryce. We haven't seen him in a while. Unfortunately, though, Lorca did not make an appearance. I really like Jason Isaacs, and I wish they'd bring him back. I think it was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, the process of convincing the crew would have been much different if the captain was there. You'd only have to convince the captain, and then the captain would do it. But in the case of the story as we saw it, you have to convince every individual crew member. You know, fans have asked a lot of questions about whether we would ever learn more about the version of Zora we saw a few years ago in the short treks entitled Calypso. Discovery's crew in that short treks had left 1,000 years earlier, and the ship was the 23rd century version before the refit that, among other things, disconnected the warp nacelles and all those other changes. In Face the Strange, we meet a Zora that is in an alternate timeline, 30 years in the future, where her crew has been killed. Burnham and Rainer leave via the next time loop jump, vowing to put right what once went wrong. So that at least partially explains this version of Zora, a millennium in the future. It must be a different timeline, because, again, it is a Discovery version before the refit that we see in Calypso. It's not floating near the debris from Starfleet headquarters, which, remember, is way out in deep space. That's not what's in orbit around Earth. That's way out in deep space, so it would probably still likely be detectable even 1,000 years in the future.
Sure. It would still be there, right?
And Zora might be station-keeping with the wreckage.
Yeah. Well, how about some quick takes, Michael? Are we ready for those?
Sure. One of the biggest technobabble lines in this episode is from Stamets. He has to build a chronoton stabilizer to partition the world lines per Scaravelli's constant.
Yep.
Okay. I tried to look up Scaravelli. There's nothing out there on the internet about Scaravelli's constant in the real world, I should say. But if you search on Scaravelli's constant, most of the hits you get are going to be about a woman who was an expert in yoga. So I'm wondering if one of the writers was maybe a yogi and selected that name.
Could be.
Last podcast, I talked a bit about the similarity of the names Maul and Locke with the Canaanite god Moloch from the Christian Bible. And I noted last time that they always say Maul and Locke, never Locke and Maul. Mm-hmm. But in this episode, various characters have started switching them back and forth. So I still think the studios are pretty careful about vetting character names, so I still think that there's a possibility that there's going to be some symbolism here to be revealed down the road.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that, Michael. You convinced me last time, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. I want to talk about the title of this episode, Base of Strange. I mean, it could refer to the moment in the turbo lift when Burnham comes face to face with her past self. In fact, there's no doubt it refers to that. I think it could also be an allusion to the David Bowie song Changes. I'm a big Bowie fan, and some of the lyrics of that song might apply to Burnham. A million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I'd got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. And he also sings about being a faker, which is how Burnham felt about herself during her first few weeks aboard Discovery. So I don't know. I'll let someone who is better at analyzing lyrics figure out how exactly this is relevant. It wouldn't surprise me if it is, though.
You know, you told me you were going to bring this up, so I've been thinking about it a little bit. And I don't know about the song lyrics, but face the strange. Strange here is used as a noun, not an adjective. It's not a strange something. It's the strange.
Right.
So I think we can take it to mean face the stranger or face the strangeness. And there are a lot of people in this episode who, on the one hand, were very familiar, but not quite who we expected because of the time shifting. Pretty much every encounter was with someone who is at least a bit of a stranger.
That's a good point, Michael. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about change later.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. This is certainly relevant to that.
I did think it was kind of brassy for Burnham to just sashay onto the bridge and announce, I'm a time traveler.
Yeah.
But I also thought it was pretty funny later in the episode when Burnham makes the crack about, with this crew, they'll get it as soon as we say time bug. So maybe it was the right strategy, knowing them as well as she did.
Yeah.
Speaking of the bug, I think, just for the record, that it is supposed to be a real insect, not a device. When I first saw it in the previews last week, I figured maybe it was a little device that was just made to look like an insect. But they give it a taxonomic name, Crenum chronophage. Maybe it is a bug, but maybe it's been genetically engineered with the time bollocksing ability and all that. And the bug also sends out a beacon for Mullenlock to trace. And then Mullenlock used the bug and the time loops to keep the Discovery crew off balance while they find whatever was at this location Janelle sent them to. And now Discovery has to chase them down. We've met the Krennen before, Rodney, in the Voyager episode Year of Hell. They were kind of the antagonists in that episode, meaning that the Krennen were from way, way out in the Delta Quadrant. But in that episode, in Voyager, the Krennen did have some weapons that made some use of chronotons.
Hmm.
So maybe there's a connection there. And speaking of the bug, shouldn't the transporter filter notice this bug when Adira beams up from Trill? Are they beaming up mosquitoes and cockroaches and things every time they go down to a planet?
Well, you know, I'm thinking, you know, that filter, we've seen in some episode somewhere that the filter will recognize something only if it's been programmed to.
I guess that's a good point.
Then the next question is, why isn't this in the filter?
So. Yeah, well, it's you know, it's black market tech, but anyway, so but good point you made there. In the time loop in which Discovery is actually in the time vortex traveling to the future, did you notice all the foam rocks on the floor, like I talked about last podcast?
I did not.
A bunch of, I'm sure that's what they are, chunks of black foam. I thought it was funny that when the ship was being built back on Earth, the worker we met has earbuds in.
Yeah.
So 21st century. So 21st century. During the loop that puts them in the battle with Control, Burnham notes that it is Stardate 1051.8, and that matches very well with the star dates given in the final episodes of season 2.
Oh, okay. So you checked that.
Yep.
Good.
Yep. We got a hint of insight about Maul's motivation here, and she appears to be the brains of the operation, if you ask me. Locke is just kind of following along. But she talks about no longer having a price on their heads and about freedom. And I wonder if it's the Breen who have a price on their heads, and Maul wants to get free essentially by paying them off with the progenitor tech.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. That makes sense because I was thinking, you know, they have Starfleet on their tail. It's they, you know, they're being pursued with this tech So how are they going to be free as long as they've got? But that does make sense. I did want to mention something else about Locke, though. Mole not only seems to be the brains of the outfit, but she seems to be the leader. And I wouldn't be surprised if at some point Locke maybe has a change of heart when he sees or realizes what could happen with this tech they're pursuing and trying
could to be,
steal.
Yeah.
We'll see.
When the crew member walks into engineering and Burnham and Stamets and Rayner all shout, "Get out!"
Yeah.
Did it make you think of Marge in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home? Remember when Marge enters the office where they're all talking about transparent aluminum? It's the same kind of thing. She opens the door to walk in and she turns around and backs right out. Reno mentions a Rothko painting, and that's a reference to Mark Rothko, who was an abstract painter, best known for a style known as abstract expressionism. He often used large rectangular regions of color on his paintings, intended to cause an emotional response in those viewing it. He was born in 1903 and died 1970. And finally, for this part of the podcast, beyond the technical television magic that was required to have Burnham in hand-to-hand combat with herself, yeah, I want to go back to this question of the two of them at different points in their lives, because they really reflect different points in Burnham's character development arc. You have to watch closely, but most of the scenes where they're fighting are done the traditional way. You have a stunt double, and the stunt double is facing away from the camera, and the actor is facing toward the camera, and you know, a very traditional way. In the old days, when there were scenes that we would see both faces, it would be an actor standing in front of a rear projection screen that was recorded earlier. But the turbo lift scene where we can see the faces of both Burnhams, I assume that that today is done in the computer, either with a green screen or some kind of computer graphics equivalent of that. But it was interesting. In this week's Ready Room, they mentioned Burnham's different fighting style today versus when she'd only been on Discovery a few weeks. It's subtle, but if you watch closely when the two of them are fighting, and even other scenes of past Burnham versus today's Burnham, they do act differently. They speak differently. Past Burnham, even more than today's Burnham, is just very aggressively taking the weight of the galaxy on her shoulders and trying to fend off what she thinks is a shape-changer invasion. And even their body language is different, which I think shows a lot of attention to detail by Sonequa Martin-Green and also the fight coordinator or coordinators on the production team. So very interesting. It was done in a way that was very subtle, but you could really see that these two versions of Burnham are at different places in their lives.
Yeah, very thoughtful and with great care and attention to detail. I loved it. I thought it was a great scene. But why don't we move on to our discussion of meaning in this episode? We're looking for messages here that the writers and producers might have wanted to convey to us, or, you know, lessons that we found, whether they were put there intentionally or not.
And Rodney, we've already noted in past podcasts that the overarching theme of this season seems to be connections. And in this episode, it is the act of making and demonstrating connections that saves the day. Burnham and Rayner showing that they absolutely know this past version of the bridge crew by citing knowledge that would not be in any public files or anything like that, like Reese's love of 23rd century Constitution class starships, Tilly's concern about sharing quarters with a mutineer, and Arium being willing to sacrifice herself.
Yeah, and notice that what Rayner knows about the crew from their files is not enough, right? Like you were saying, this is stuff that won't be found in their files, right? And this knowledge that he uses to help save the day comes from talking to the crew. You know, Reese's love of the Constitution class, Burnham's feeling that she didn't deserve to be on Discovery back in season one, right? It's a good thing that he's starting to talk to these people and connect with them now.
Yeah, the character development arc for Rayner that we've predicted is certainly showing itself now, both in his relationship with Burnham and in how he treats others on both the current and the past crew. He's getting there, I think.
Yeah, I feel like at the end of this episode that he's learned his lesson. He says at the end that their familiarity with the crew allowed them to complete the mission. So he's getting it.
Yeah, and Rayner knows just what to say to Stamets when Stamets is weighted down by the stress of the situation, maybe in part because both of them have this experience with gruff candor. But Rayner also counsels Burnham, and he knows just what to say to the others to show that he does know them in the modern parlance. He sees them, even if he's been a bit cool so far. And I think his subconscious does want to make connections, but he still feels awkward about it due to his demotion and the circumstances. So I think, I'm not sure that he's completely turned the page, but he's getting better. And although I wonder if some of his wall may still be up. So we'll have to see, how quickly he progresses along this direction. Burnham in this episode also talks about how she and her crew use their connections. She says, we can use them to keep us honest and make us better, as opposed to just sloughing off, being too familiar and having it reduce their effectiveness and efficiency and mission accomplishment.
And she agrees with Rayner that that is a potential problem.
Yeah.
But on the whole, it's positive. And I felt like, you know, Rayner, in a way, at the end of this episode, he's a part of the crew in a way he wasn't before. He's connected with them. Mm-hmm. And starting to use those connections. And in the final scene, you know, Burnham says that she's really glad that they all came together. And we get a shot of Rayner as they glance at each other.
Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of comment in this episode about change, particularly in Burnham counseling Rayner and in their conversations.
Yeah, I actually think this was the main theme of the episode.
Okay. Well, Burnham says that change is difficult, but we have to trust the voice in our head. Another conversation, she tells Rayner that change is hard, but we have to accept the new things. And Burnham also tells past book, when she surprise encounters him in her quarters, that yes, change can be hard.
Yeah, I guess the way I would summarize it is change is hard, but we can't give up because that's how meaningful things happen. I think that's the message of the episode. And I think this theme is related to the theme of connections. Now, when Rayner is talking to Stamets, he says that he thought gruff candor was what Stamets needed because he's the brilliant scientist that everything's hanging on. And Stamets tells him things change and not every problem is something you can figure out on your own. So there's another reason why Rayner needs to be personally acquainted with his crew, needs to make these connections, because the files, well, they become dated and inaccurate, right?
Yeah,
so there's a connection there.
Yeah, and you need insight. You need deeper insight into the people to know how to interact with them on this particular occasion in these particular circumstances. You know, Rodney, Rayner has several times talked about the mission, about mm-hmm. the Red Directive making this mission so important, mission accomplishment. And this is not just his experience with the Byrne talking. It is the mindset of a military-style organization. But an important part of mission accomplishment is the people. If people are happy, satisfied, rewarded, feel valued, it just automatically contributes to mission accomplishment and readiness for mission accomplishment.
Look, Starfleet is maybe a quasi-military organization, but it's not really a military organization. And maybe Rayner has taken the quasi-military nature of Starfleet a bit too far here. And he needs to course correct, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it is a defensive organization. It's an exploration organization. But even though it is not or quasi-military, it's organized along military lines.
Yeah.
It uses the military right. context, you might say. And he is used to a context where things were really, really, really tough. And that, through his career, you know, has framed how he approaches the job. And yes, it is time now for him to see that, well, you know, things are different now. And how do I fit myself into this new context?
Right. Things have changed.
Yep.
There's another thing, Michael, I wanted to talk about here. Something I was noticing about Mull and Locke. They're connected to each other, no doubt.
Yeah.
Apparently, though, as far as we know, they're not connected to anyone or anything else. Maybe the writers want to say that when we lack meaningful connections to others, our actions can have disastrous effects for others, right? Whereas the crew of Discovery, connected as they are to each other and to Starfleet and the Federation, they're doing good. You know, they save the Federation in this episode, and it seems like they might have to do it again before the season's over, so I guess the stakes again are sky high this season. But anyway, I'm just thinking about the different kinds of motivations politicians might have for their actions. I think some of them really do care about their country and their fellow citizens, and that helps them figure out what they're going to do. But then you have others who, of course, have these purely self-interested motivations. And consequently, I think their actions create a lot of collateral damage. So I wonder if this is going to emerge again or emerge as a theme this season.
I think it will be interesting to see whether and how Maul begins to feel a connection. And remember, Book is kind of sort of her uncle, sort of.
Because
her dad was his mentor.
Right.
And he feels that she's close family. But, and I haven't gone back to review this. Didn't she say something about her dad leaving early in her life? Or, I mean, I wasn't sure that she had a strong connection to her dad. But I wonder if at least Book's side of that equation at some point will come to influence her. I think she'll have a character development arc, too.
Yes. And if she didn't say that, it might have been something that Book said as they were, talking about what they know about her. Are we ready for some final thoughts here, Michael, about Face the Strange?
I am, yes. This was the equivalent of a standalone episode. I mean, the entire season is hyper-serialized. It's a story arc. But at the end of the episode, they're not really farther along on finding clues to the progenitor's tech than they were to begin with, except that Zora's alternate timeline leads us to know that there's the potential for the Breen to wipe out Starfleet using this tech. It appears to put a rest to my idea that the progenitor tech might be something that cannot be weaponized, something completely different, because we have now seen it weaponized. But this was kind of a break. We're not directly forcing the next step in the process of finding clues, but something gave us a lot of character insight and things. You know, we've talked about defining the stakes of this season. Past seasons, the stakes have often been like everything everywhere, all intelligent life in the galaxy, things like that. And now, essentially, the stakes are defined as saving Starfleet, which in effect probably means saving the Federation and preventing all the consequences that were to happen if that were to occur, even though the Federation itself is still in the process of rebuilding and not at its former strength. On the one hand, you could say, we didn't need another time loop episode. But as we've said many times, there are few really new ideas. And the question is, how do you mix them together? And innovation is how we define creativity. So if you can find new, fresh, innovative ways to do it, then that is a creative use of the story idea. And I think in this episode, the time loop is a vehicle for some really good, strong character development and interaction. So I enjoyed it.
And this was not a time loop episode for the sake of having a time loop episode. I mean, it was fun. I enjoyed the episode. I was sitting on the edge of my seat for at least part of it. But it did service the character development and the theme.
Yeah, the theme.
You know, we saw Rayner, as another example of that, we saw Rayner getting to know Burnham a little bit better. You know, so at the one point there, he's talking to Past Burnham saying, you're going to make a damn fine captain. So again, it's that is in service to the theme. And so I really appreciate that this was a time loop episode with a purpose.
And help me out here, but it's interesting because I'm not sure I remember in previous Discovery seasons them being built around a single unifying theme. I mean, we've had strong morals to the story and the overarching kind of multi-season themes like Found Family and Who Am I, but I'm not remembering a particular explicit theme that they address in previous Discovery seasons and address it in every episode, which is happening here. So I think that is an interesting way of building the story. Remember, this season was filmed as we record this about a year ago in the spring of 2023, meaning the story arc was probably blocked out and scripted sometime in 2022, because there's quite a bit of time that they need for pre-production after the scripts are done. And, you know, what was happening in 2022? It was when most of the COVID restrictions were just being relaxed. People started coming out of self-imposed or government-imposed isolation. Some haven't yet, really. Mm-hmm. So that in and itself, I think, could have been a justification for this theme of connections, because so many people, when they were stuck at home or only interacting through the internet, did feel a loss of connections. They did feel that problem. And in addition to that, though, around the world, we've been seeing kind of the growth of, if you will, tribalism, trying to roll back rights, attempts to reject diversity and inclusion, simple unwillingness to understand the life and experiences of people that have different backgrounds from your own. So I think that may also have been part of the justification for selecting this season-long theme of connections, and maybe connections and change closely related, as you've pointed out. I can definitely see the people in the writer's room making that decision. The theme is pretty well defined now, four episodes into the season, and it's a 10-episode season, so I think in the next few we can expect to see, now that it's defined, see it developed further in the next few Discovery episodes.
Absolutely. We'll continue to see it. There's no way they're dropping it at this point. Yeah. I think this is locked in place. And, you know, what you say makes sense. And I think maybe this is a good time, the right time for a theme like this.
Yeah. It was in 2022 when they were planning it out, and it still is today.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Well, that about does it for us. For this episode of our podcast, we thank you for joining us today. We'll be back for episode 5 of Discovery's final season, entitled Mirrors, next week. Watch for our podcast updates on Mastodon, Twitter, and Facebook at Trek_Academy, and on Tumblr at Trek Academy without the underscore. You can search for us online. Search for Star Trek Academy Podcast and look for our red Vulcan hand salute logo. Who knows? Maybe that's how you found us this time. And don't forget to subscribe via your podcast app to automatically get the new podcast downloads. Thank you for being here, and we'll see you next time on the Star Trek Academy Podcast.